Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 2nd, 2003. Today's session is, How Can We Get Along with Difficult People? Session 3 of State of Mind and the Nature of Wisdom, presented by Rolf Evanson. The number is EVR2003-03. Let's listen in.
My son was asking me the other day, so Dad, are you going to be teaching today? And I said, yes, I am. And he said, what are you going to talk about? The usual stuff? And so I said, yeah, the usual stuff. And then he said, well, would you like some advice? And I said, sure, Chell, what's your advice? And he said, don't start talking to them like you talk to me, because that's really boring. So I'm going to try not to talk to you like I talk to my son. Although I try not to talk that way when I'm talking to him, too, and it doesn't seem to work. So I'll just have to do my best. Welcome, everyone. How many are new to Holden today? Just one. And how many here are coming to one of my classes for the first time? Okay. Well, my name is Rolf Evanson, and I'm from the Boulder, Colorado area, a small town called Lafayette. I'm here with my wife, Lori, who's sitting by the back wall there. She volunteered to go like this if it's time to stop. So I'm looking for that starting about now. I grew up in Minnesota, and I've spent roughly 10 years each working as a wilderness guide in various parts of the country, working as a licensed architect, mostly in New Mexico and Colorado. And then for the last 10 years, I've been working with individuals and companies and organizations, helping people live life from a deeper sense of common sense and wisdom. So I do a lot of counseling and coaching, helping people access their own inner resources. The overall theme of the sessions that we've been having this week are state of mind and the nature of wisdom. Now that sounds like kind of a highfalutin title, I know. And I'd like to say that in some ways it is, because it's grounded in the nature of being. It's grounded, the conversations we've been having is grounded in the nature of life. And when you talk about life on a deep level, it's almost impossible for the conversation not to take philosophical and theological and spiritual overtones. But I'd like to emphasize also that it's very simple. And I'm going to try to keep things simple today, because I think that simple is helpful. At least it is for me. You know, and if people could go home with just one glimmer of an insight that could change how you see human beings interacting with one another, that would be great. Because if you could have that insight that changes how you see relationships, you'll never forget that. We become changed people when we have an insight that changes how we see the world. Because when we see the world differently, we respond to it differently. What makes sense to us changes. What we do changes. How we feel changes based on an insight. We talked about, we shared a story the other day about a group that I was guiding, and we got lost in a huge swamp for about a day and a half. And I finally saw a huge white pine tree in the distance and was able to climb that tree, and I could see where we had made our mistake. I could see where we'd been, I could see where we got off, and I could see what we needed to do to get out of this swamp, out of this nightmare. And I think in life, that's the role that personal insight plays. We often get caught up in life, don't we? We just get caught up in it. We just get caught up in the hustle and bustle of it. We get caught up in our to-do lists. We get caught up in our endless responsibilities. We get caught up in feeling aggravated and stressed. And we're just really living in the swamp of our lives when we're like that. But then sometimes we'll have an insight that changes it, where we suddenly see it from a completely different perspective, because being in that swamp really means that we've just lost our perspective. We've just temporarily lost our bearings, and we've just gotten caught up in life. Or in a relationship, we've gotten out of kilter. You know, somebody has said something and it's just ticked us off. It just got under our fingernails, so to speak, and it got us going. We talked about the importance of state of mind. I'm gonna review a little bit about what we've talked about, so that those of you that weren't in the previous two classes can catch up, okay? So those of you that have been at the previous classes, I hope that doing a little bit of review will be interesting to you as well. So one of the things that we talked about is the power of state of mind. State of mind is nothing but the quality of our thinking in any given moment. Now, as I was growing up, I knew that my state of mind changed. I was living in it, so you know, it wasn't anything too magical about that. Sometimes I felt good, and sometimes I didn't. Sometimes I felt hopeful, and sometimes I felt depressed. Sometimes people around me looked like manifestations of God, and sometimes the people around me didn't, based on how I was feeling. And one of the things I noticed is that when I was in a what I would call a healthy state of mind, my, doesn't life get easy? You have those experiences where it just feels like you're just flowing along, you know, you're just in the river of life, and you're not worried about things, and you're not fretting over things, and you're not experiencing tension with people, and you just feel like your life is in balance. Has everyone felt that? Raise your hand if you felt that. Now, have you noticed when you feel that, how easy life is? It's interesting, isn't it? Because when we're in that state of mind, we're living the same life, aren't we? We're on the same planet. We're faced with the same issues, both globally, internationally, locally, and in our personal life. So the only thing that has changed is the quality of our experience, and that's coming from our thinking. When our thinking changes, our state of mind changes. And when our state of mind changes, everything changes in terms of how we experience life. Take a simple example of doing the dishes. Have you ever done the dishes when you were really grumpy? I mean, dishes are a pain when you're grumpy, aren't they? You know, there's so many things about life that really suck when you're grumpy. And this morning I was on dish crew with Lori and Amy Carlson, and we had a blast. we had a blast. We were joking and we were having water fights and we were getting the dishes done really fast. We got them done in less than 1 hour. That's what happens when we're in a healthy state of mind. It's like our state of mind is like the grease that, or the oil in the car. The car will run for a while without it, but not for very long. Now, in terms of dealing with difficult people, has anyone here ever experienced a difficult person?
No, we are the difficult people. That's why we're here.
Is anyone here a difficult person? You know, the title of the class should have been "How to Deal with Difficult People, Including Us." Because haven't you noticed that we're all difficult at times? We notice the other people when they're difficult. But aren't we just as difficult the other half of the time? And why is it that the same person can be so wonderful one minute, and so loving, and so compassionate, and so thoughtful, and such a crank the next? It's the same person. Well, I would like to suggest that state of mind has an awful lot to do with it. Here's a story that might help illustrate this. I don't really remember all the details anymore because it happened quite a while ago, but I remember one time coming home from work and I was very tired. And Lori was busy getting dinner on the table. And I was already, I would say, slipping into my state of mind was marginal, because one of the things that drops us into a lower state of mind is fatigue. And if we've been working too hard for too long, our state of mind starts slipping. So I was marginal walking in the door. And then Lori said something. I have no idea what it was, but it might have been about mowing the lawn, or not wiping the counter just right or something. And that just got me. That hooked me. And pretty soon we were into it. And then both of our minds, state of mind, started slipping down. And now you have two people in a low state of mind. And for those of you that have been in the classes up till now, what happens to the quality of our thinking when our state of mind drops? It goes in the tank, doesn't it? Our state of mind drops, and the quality of our thinking drops. See, I didn't know that. I thought that my angry thinking was just as valuable, just as valid as my happy thinking. I took it seriously. And so we started finding all kinds of things to argue about. It's funny how all those things that your rubbing points come up when you're in a low state of mind, and you have two people who are caught up in a personal thought storm, and they get together and decide to create a hurricane. That's what happens when two people who are suffering from a thought storm get together and try to do anything, whether it's do the dishes, raise the kids, or balance the checkbook. It doesn't matter what we're trying to do, does it? When we're in that kind of state of mind, forget it. It's going to be hard, it's going to be painful, things aren't going to get done, and if we get anything done, we're probably going to forget we even got it done very quickly. So what we learned is that is to recognize state of mind. It's like we've gotten this, it's like a warning light on your car when you're driving across the country. If the engine light goes on, we all know that that's something we have to pay attention to, and we have to pull over because otherwise the engine might blow up. And noticing state of mind is something wonderfully simple like that. If in that moment we can just notice our state of mind and say, whoops, what do we do when our car light goes off? What do?
Stop.
You stop. You pull over. You do whatever makes sense. You make a phone call. You get to a garage if you can. You drive to the garage if you think it's a reasonable thing to do. Or if you don't think it's a reasonable to do, you make a phone call. But you do whatever makes sense until you understand what's going on and the situation is resolved. So we discovered that if we would just notice state of mind and notice when we were off, when we had lost our balance, notice when the road grader was past the windows. If we would just take a bit of a time out, something miraculous would happen. Our natural state of well-being would return. Once we'd gotten through the stress point, once we'd gotten the dishes done, once the kids were in bed, once we'd had a chance to have a good night's sleep, or whatever it was that we needed to just get back in balance, regain our bearings. Let's just do something for fun. Let's call this side state of well-being. And on this side we'll call it, what should we call it? Caught up in a storm?
Grumpy.
Okay, we'll just call it grumpy. Grumpy state of mind. Okay. Now let's just talk about quality of thinking, quality of thought. What kind of quality of thought happens when we're in a grumpy state of mind?
Blaming.
Pardon me?
Blame.
Blaming. Blaming comes so naturally when you're in a grumpy state of mind, doesn't it? I mean, it's not a skill that we have to develop or go to school. it just kind of rolls off of our personality.
Rationalizing?
Rationalizing.
Procrastinating.
Narrow. Very good. Procrastinating.
Defensive.
That's a very good one.
Paranoid.
I have never gotten defensive.
Me either. That's why I never heard of me.
How many of you have never gotten defensive? Yeah. Angry.
Vindictive.
Oh yeah. Let's get into it.
Paranoid? Somebody said something over here. Was it
protective?
It's negative. Yeah, narrow is an interesting one because how much creativity is there in narrow?
Nothing.
Nada. Did I miss one? Did someone just
protective.
Say
just negative?
Pardon me?
Protective,
yeah. When we start feeling like we've got to protect our turf, that we want to look good, that we want everybody to know that we're okay, whether we are or not. What else?
Negative.
Negative.
Self-centered.
Pardon me?
Self-centered.
Self-centered.
Isolated.
Yeah.
Boy, we are really good at filling this out.
You see how easy this is? You guys are excellent students. You must have a lot of experience in life. How many people here have lived at least 20 years? How many people have at least 20 years of experience feeling self-centered? You get the gist of it, don't you? Yeah, what's another one?
Along with narrow, would be short-term kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. We have judgmental on here? We should.
Petty?
Yeah.
How about impulsive?
Petty was one.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What kind of thinking goes with us in a state of well-being, which every one of us has experienced many times in our lives? What is our thinking? What is the quality of our thinking when we are in that natural state of well-being?
Positive.
Generous.
Generous. Yeah.
Relaxed.
Mm-hmm. Grateful.
Loving.
Understanding.
Generous.
Flexible.
Open.
Self-confident.
Yeah, yeah, break that.
Faster.
Creative.
Optimistic.
Intuitive.
Affirming.
Insightful.
Happy. Humorous.
Oh yeah. God bless humor. That's this side, isn't it? At least the lighthearted humor. Sometimes we have mean-spirited humor over there.
Patient.
There's not a whole lot of patience over here, is there?
Sensitive.
Sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
Sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
Sympathetic.
Enthusiastic.
Enthusiasm. Which side has the energy? I mean, there might be some angry energy over here, but in terms of the productive energy, yeah, of solving problems, of finding a way to work together in a creative way, of getting the job done, of creating things, it's all over here, isn't it? It's all over here. Now, isn't it also true that we all live both places, don't we? That one of the things that we talked about the other day is that our states of mind just naturally ebb and flow. They just naturally ebb and flow. Is there anyone here whose state of mind doesn't ebb and flow? I think God created us that way. And I think that it makes perfect sense because everything in nature ebbs and flows. Why would we be any different? So where the rub comes is that we fail to recognize how critically important this ebb and flow is to the success in our relationships, the success in our organizations, the success in our ventures of any kind. Because if we don't recognize that, what will happen is we'll get in a grumpy state of mind, and I'll say, okay, Lori, we got to talk about this. right now, because I'm upset right now. And if she gets upset along the way, then we're really having fun. And now we have a combined emotional IQ of about 3. And we're going to try to solve our problem. Boy, that makes sense, doesn't it? There's that old wives' tale about never go to bed angry. That's an interesting one, isn't it? Now you understand where that came from. It came from a person who had an insight that they valued a relationship and they didn't want the good feeling to go away. And so it made sense to them to think, well, if we never go to bed angry, then we'll always get the good feeling back. But the problem with that is then you have two people in a grumpy state of mind who are progressively more exhausted the later it gets, and the more and more difficult it gets, doesn't it? It can get really difficult. If we will just recognize state of mind, when we get out of sync with somebody, when we start having a problem, it is so helpful to just step back and ask yourself, what is my state of mind? So often what happens is that we'll say words to each other, and the words may make perfect sense, but there's an edge to them. There's a feeling behind the words. And what we're reacting to is not the words, we react to the feeling, don't we? So if Lori is suggesting that I mow the lawn, it may be that the lawn needs mowing. It's based in reality. The lawn really is this lawn. But if there's a judgmental feeling behind her words, then it's easy for me to react to the feeling. Is this making sense so far? Mm-hmm. Are there any questions?
When are you going to move along?
It probably could really use a mow right now. I'm so glad that you can't see it. Out of sight, out of mind.
When you talk about the ebb and flow, I was just thinking about the difference between introverts and extroverts, and how being an introvert, you know, I really feel tired after being in a situation with a big group and stuff like that, and so I need some time to... So that's part of that ebb and flow is getting that time to kind of regroup, and extroverts feeding on that kind of group dynamic.
See, I don't know, and help, correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense with introverts and extroverts is they have different ways of thinking about being in groups. That the extrovert, whatever the extrovert is thinking as he goes into a group or she's going into a group, that if you could see what they were thinking, make their thinking visible, you would see that they were thinking very different thoughts than the introvert. The introvert might be thinking thoughts of, man, how am I going to make, you know, what am I going to talk about? You know, what, who am I going to connect with? And now I'm going to have to act nice and be sociable, you know, and boy, that's a lot of work. And you get in there, and it is a lot of work because you're creating that with your own thinking. One thing that really I used to have that feeling myself, and one thing that really changed for me was when I started realizing that I could go into a group of people and just get curious about them as human beings and follow my curiosity. And it took the pressure off of me. And I was able to go in and just relax and have a good time and feel no pressure. But I think in terms of being an introvert or extrovert, we all experience state of mind. So you can be a depressed introvert or you can be an introvert in a state of well-being.
It seems like
For some folks who are especially quiet, they're more easily misunderstood. But then on the other hand, for some people who are especially extroverted, they're often misunderstood because they're more out there. And so there's confusion because people have different levels of out-there-ness or whatever you call it. And that makes it hard to tell if they are grumpy or happy.
You know what? That's a great point. How do we know? Sometimes it's obvious if somebody's in a state of well-being or not, isn't it? But sometimes it's not. How do we know if we're in a healthy state of mind ourselves? What tells us that? What's the red light on the dashboard that tells us what our level of thinking is?
How we hear what is said to us.
Mm-hmm. Or even how we hear what we say to ourselves. If my interior conversation is all about what hurts and it's a lousy day and what I haven't gotten done and, you know, by the time I get to school, I know that I need to warn the children that they should probably walk around.
We should wear a big sign. Don't even think about it.
Yeah. So I think it's, I know when I can hear my interior conversation.
So sometimes we can see it just from the words, the way that we hear other people.
Well, and this has taken me also back to something that goes on both sides of that is tone of voice that we talked about earlier. Because that, I think that really is a biggie.
Yeah.
Tone of voice can, who cares what the words are? I mean, sometimes the words don't matter, but when you hear the tone of voice,
right,
it can flip me out anyway.
Yeah. What these things are pointing to is human feeling. We can feel when we're off, and we can feel when someone else is off. We had a diagram here the other day. Heart looks like if you measure it on some kind of machine, electromagnetic something or other.
EKG.
What is it?
It's an EKG.
Is that what that is?
Okay. Electrocardiogram.
And they had people just remember and something that made them angry for 5 minutes, and this is what their EKG looked like. And then they had some people remember a time when they were feeling compassion or caring for someone. And this is what their EKG looked like. And these things can be measured from 8 to 10 feet away. That surprised me. I didn't know that. From 8 to 10 feet away, they could measure the heart's EKG, I guess, with machines. So is it any surprise that we can feel when the feeling's off? We can just feel it.
You've erased all the grumpy state of mind adjectives, but we know what they are. But the word grumpy makes it sound like somebody's just having an off day, or there are problems, or they're irritated. But I'm thinking, I mentioned yesterday when I asked the question, sometimes when people are in grief, when they are grieving the loss of a loved one, they are all those things you have listed under grumpy state of mind.
Yeah.
And grumpy isn't fair, I don't think, to call them. But
right.
That's all the things, almost everyone I saw out there is like a man I mentioned yesterday.
Yeah.
And it's been several months since his wife died, and we all want to help him, but he won't let us.
Yeah.
So I hope you're going to give us some clues to how we can help somebody else's state of mind.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one, isn't it? Because we run into that kind of situation in all kinds of situations where our spouse is upset about something or depressed about something, or our kids are struggling at school, or we have a friend like yours who is suffering a loss, or someone, one of my clients is struggling with breast cancer. So there are many situations, aren't there, where people have real reasons to feel grief or fear or disappointment. This client of mine talked about how disappointed she was in her body because it was turning against her. Well, that's a legitimate thing to feel when you have cancer. So then the question becomes, how do we move through those experiences in a real and direct way, but not recreate them in our minds over and over again for the rest of our lives or for an endless period of time? And I don't know if this is the right moment to address it. I want to get to that question today. Okay, so if I haven't done it by the bell at 15 minutes to 5, please remind me and we'll come to that.
Maybe there was a reason that women in a family wore black upon the death of a husband or a loved one for, I think, a year in some cultures. And then, in fact, I think that the widows wore black the rest of their lives. The daughters could wear black for. Maybe there's a reason for that. And maybe sometimes we have expectations that something is going to be turned around really before it's appropriate for that. And I've been guilty of a buck up, sort of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. On one side, there's the, come on, buck up, get over it. And we've all felt that. And then on the flip side of that is someone who gets caught up in grieving and can't get out of it.
I think the worst experience of being judged for our family came when my oldest brother died, and my siblings and I got together with my parents and chopped firewood for 3 days. And we were harshly criticized by our minister, who felt that was a very inappropriate way to grieve. And I was hurt by that. I just thought, from that point on, I've tried extremely hard never to judge how somebody handles that kind of pain, because it's so individual and so deep, and not for any of us to judge.
Yeah.
It's appropriate to give people time and space, but then to let them use it the way they need to use it.
There's a funny thing happened with my kids once. In fact, it's one of the stories in this book. They don't use our names, but Joe Bailey, the person who wrote this book, asked if he could use the story of the book. The book is a delightful series of real life stories, some of them about serious issues like the ones you're bringing up, death in the family and cancer and paralysis from a hockey injury and so on. And then others are more lighthearted, like the one that he shares from our experience. One day I was cooking dinner. Isn't it interesting how many things happen when you're cooking dinner? Why is that? I don't know. I mean, maybe it's because it's the end of the day and you're tired. I don't know why. But I was cooking up a big pot of soup, and Erin and Chell, Erin is my 14-year-old daughter, and Chell is my 12-year-old son. And this was probably, 4 or 5 years ago. So maybe they were 7 and 9, something like that. They were playing in the backyard. And I could hear things kind of escalating out there, how the tone changes, and you just kind of, you pick that up as a parent. You just have a fifth sense about the feeling that changes, and it's going from, I don't think they're having as much fun as they were having 10 minutes ago. And then pretty soon it just blew up, and I could hear them just screaming at each other. And I was just about to head out there and pull him apart when Chell came storming in the front door, and he was furious. He was so mad. And he just comes stomping in and says, I could just kill Erin. I hate her. I hate her. I can't stand playing with her. He's like that. I say, come on, Chell, come on up here and sit at the counter while I cook this soup. And I knew intuitively that there was no way I could talk him out of this anger. I mean, it was just going to take a while for him to just de-escalate and kind of calm down. And so I didn't even try to talk him out of it. I just hoped that sitting with me and the fact that I wasn't upset, that he would resonate with my goodwill and that he would calm down. And I tried talking to him a couple of times, and he was just sitting there like this, you know, and his jaw was set, his eyes were sharp, and he was just kind of all red and purple, and he was so angry. And I'm stirring the soup, and after about 10 minutes, I looked up, and he had completely changed. His face was normal color again. And he was looking at the soup. He was watching me stir. He said, "Dad, can I help you stir that soup?" And I looked at him and I said, "Chill, what happened?" And he said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, a minute ago, you were furious. Your jaw was grinding. Your face was all red, and your lips were tight, and your eyes were breathing fire, and all you could say was terrible things about Aaron, and now I'm looking at you and you have this calm and sparkle is back in your eye and your jaw is relaxed. And can you feel the difference?" "Yeah, I can feel the difference." I said, "Well, what happened?" And then he looked up and he said, "My thoughts changed. My thoughts changed." And when his thoughts changed, his experience changed. That's what we talked about yesterday. Our thoughts lead to feelings, which lead to our state of mind, which affects how we act, which results in our results. So what happened in this situation, as long as he was thinking what a jerk his sister was and how mean she had been to do whatever she had done, he was literally in that rage, and his body chemistry went along for the ride.
Then did you kind of answer her question?
Pardon me?
Did you then kind of answer her question about her friend? How can we help someone else's state of mind? If we could maybe bring that understanding to them that their thoughts are what create the feeling that makes the action, perhaps then one, you know, even if you don't have the feeling, you can make your thoughts, you can say, "These would be better thought, you know, I can get on with my life, I can do play the piano like I've always wanted to, I'll get a piano teacher and I'll do this, and I'll do something for me." Even if you don't feel like doing it, because you don't, you're miserable and you're horrible and everything's terrible. But you do that and then the feeling will come and then, you know, it'll...
Eventually your thinking changes and you start creating a new experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a great comment. And what you're pointing to is the fact that when we experience something, there is certainly legitimate grieving that needs to take place. But then, because the gift that God has given us, the gift to create our experience with our thinking, is so powerful and works so beautifully, that if we keep thinking how sad we are, or how angry we are, or how so-and-so done us wrong, we can recreate that whole experience over and over again, can't we?
But we need to allow people to do it in their own time.
Yeah.
And perhaps if your friend, you know, you're feeling that your friend is just going too far, I think by letting them have this knowledge, and then perhaps they could do it for a little bit. You know, they don't have to You know, they're not going to all of a sudden all their thoughts change. But just one little thing to start the process.
Yeah. I think giving people permission to grieve in a way that makes sense to them is so great. And for some people it might be a month, and for others it might be a year. And who cares? As long as they're trusted, it's an honest process for them.
And but I think the same goes for anger or any other emotion. Mm-hmm. I think it's okay to say to somebody, you know, it's okay to be angry. Go ahead, be angry, get it out, and then, but don't act, you know, don't hurt yourself or other people in the process, and then move on with your thoughts.
There's some powerful stories in this book called Speed Trap, which they have over in the bookstore about this. And I would encourage those of you that have this situation in your lives to go and look at this book. There are amazing stories in there of people who have suffered the kinds of tragedies that you're talking about, who understood how thought works, and who were able to move through it amazingly quickly because they understood how thought works. And what they realized is that it didn't make sense to keep recreating the grieving feelings, the angry feelings, or whatever. That we have the power to do that. And it seems real, because when we think those thoughts, we not only think the thoughts, we go through the whole experience again. We feel the sadness. Our body changes. The biochemical reaction occurs. And we can literally do that for the rest of our lives if we choose. That's the power of thought. Or we can recognize that we're doing it to ourselves and make a common sense decision to drop it and get on with our lives.
I think what you're really asking too is how can I help my friend? And I think whether it's in grieving or it's anger, I think those are almost just details that don't matter. I think the key in the help with any of those situations, and I especially see that with our kids sometimes and having the discipline, is compassion. So I think grieving, having anger in people's own time, you know, it's what makes sense to them in the moment to grieve this long of a time or to be angry this long of a time. And the compassion that one can have, non-judgmental compassion about what they're going through, because that's what they need in that moment. I think, like with anger, sometimes we have to deal with our kids with that. And I can set a limit and say, if you do that one more time, then this is what's going to happen. And of course, one more time happens, and it's, geez, I am so sorry that you're not going to get to go out tonight. I'm really sorry, but that was what you chose to do. I'm so sorry about the grief you're, you know, suffering. And that true compassion is just so huge for people in that moment. And doing it in a healthy way, showing compassion in a healthy way. I mean, that's one of the things I think Rolf has taught me. I mean, I used to just, no, you know? I was just the no mom. And setting those limits and showing them that, you know, we're really sorry that you made that choice. But that was the choice you made. And you know what? I don't think any less of you. I still love you as much as I always did. But it's that compassion in any one of those grumpy states, whether they're being negative or narrow or whatever, because they're experiencing something totally different than what we're experiencing right now. But the one thing I know, when Rolf is really feeling bad and he just needs to get out, the ideas of, you know, go up to the cabin or whatever, all come ultimately from compassion for this really low state of mind he's in. And that in and of itself is just really helps me. And I think that that's what, you know, Christ was probably, you know, it's a moment on the cross, you know, forgive them for they know not what they do. I mean, is that any bigger path compassion in that moment right there when he said that? So
consciously, we develop a personal thought system. Now, what's interesting about this is that not only do we see life through our personal thought system, but we experience it as real. So the person who's who's inherited that discouraging attitude about life, they're not just thinking those thoughts, they're experiencing life as that way. And if you talk to your friend who sees nothing but money, that's how he experiences life. That's all he sees. He wants to know what the stock market is. He opens up the newspaper. Does he see anything in the newspaper? He goes straight to the financial piece, the business piece.
He actually lives in a state of fear, too.
Yeah.
He lives in a state of fear because he's afraid he's going to lose.
Yeah.
But here's the big question. So you're alluding that you should change these people. And we don't have the power to change them, and yet we might be related to them. So how do we relate to our relatives that are in that state of mind, seriously, without picking it up?
I think the first thing is to recognize that we all work this way, and that we are all subject to this. See, the tendency, I think, is to look out into the world and see the people with the big problems. And we miss, it's that biblical thing about seeing the log in someone else's eye, and we see the sliver in somebody else's eye, and we miss the log in our own. So I think that for starters, what's really, really helpful is to notice our own thinking, to start recognizing our own thinking, to start making what has been invisible to us visible. We all think, we all create our experience via our thinking and our state of mind, but we haven't seen it. Most people haven't recognized that. So step number one is to recognize that in ourselves. And part of what it does is it allows us to feel such compassion for people who seemingly do silly things or even mean-hearted things. Because we all do what makes sense given what we're thinking.
Many times this is about a desired state, and the desired state doesn't happen overnight. What I've seen happen with people's behavior and their view on life is through a progression of the way you treat people, the way you respond to their difficulties. And then many times it takes months, years before you see any reaction, but it can happen. And so I think the idea that you're going to help people and see a discernible result in their life overnight is probably foolish. That it's going to take a lot longer than that in a lot of cases.
If we get attached to someone else changing, we can get ourselves in trouble in a hurry. And it often happens with loved ones. My brother was alcoholic, and then he was a gambling addict. And in a situation like that, you love someone deeply, and you desperately want them to be happy and healthy. And they can't seem to find their way out of this addiction.
Which means your life has to be founded in some truth that you can count on no matter what happens.
You mean mine or theirs?
Yours.
And just tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I think it's a reason to have faith in your Creator and in Christ and to understand what life is all about. It's even defined as maturity or whatever. But you've got to be founded there, because there's going to be bumps along the way and disappointments and failures with other people in your life. But you've got to be founded in some real, real strong basics, or else you'll have that problem.
I think having that sense of grounding is so critical, so that we're less likely to get thrown off balance by things if we have that grounding. Now, I think that in any situation where you're trying to help somebody, the first place to look is inside. What is my state of mind right now? Let's say somebody calls you that's in your family and they've got problems that you're concerned about. And when my brother used to call me, I would immediately, as soon as I heard his voice, my mood would drop. And my mood would drop because I just knew that it was going to be a variation on the theme, but the theme was consistent. you know, send me money. And we finally realized that he was just gambling it all away. And so what would happen is that my mood would drop, and now the quality of my thinking has dropped, and I no longer have access to my own wisdom and my own common sense and my own insight, my own creativity. What's happened is that my insecurity has been triggered, and now I'm scared for him. So I'm not coming from faith and hope and vision and love. I'm coming from insecurity. And so what I will choose to say in response to whatever he says is not going to be very helpful, because it's not coming from an inspired place. It's coming from fear. It's fear for him. It's also fear for what I'm going to feel like if he dies, if this ends in a suicide or something. And so I think it was so helpful for me to recognize the importance in that situation, that real life situation, to first look within and get a sense of what my own state of mind was. And sometimes I had to just let him talk for a while and kind of just collect my wits, and hopefully I would regain my bearings and my common sense would start coming back. And then I would have some things to say or some questions to ask that might be based on some wisdom and common sense rather than insecurity and fear or anger. I think it's essential to have rapport with people to find a good feeling. And oftentimes when we talk, I'd be so angry at him that we couldn't find that rapport. And when I found that when I got into a healthy state of mind, I genuinely had compassion for him. I genuinely saw that he was just caught up in this craziness, and this thinking was just driving him nuts. And so my compassion came readily. And it just seemed like I knew what to say. And I also knew when I'd had enough. I had enough faith in him and a faith in me, and knew the difference of what I could do and what I couldn't do, that I had the clarity and the presence to be able to say, even though he wanted to keep talking and he hadn't gotten what he wanted and he was starting to get angry, I had the presence to say, Mark, I'm sorry, I can't talk any longer. I've got to go. This isn't feeling good to me now. And I could trust that because it was coming from a healthy place. And I also got to the place where I could say, I'm not sending you any more money. And I'm going to talk to Mother about not sending you any more money. That takes courage, but that kind of clarity comes from help. It doesn't come from dropping down into an unhealthy state of mind and then reacting with anger. Or I would either react with, I'd either be angry at him and tell him to, you know, get a life and grow up and whatever, or I would be condescending and giving him advice and, you know, treating him as, you know, less than I was.
What you're talking about here, and I think it's something that most of us resist, and that is to recognize that I am responsible for my own feelings, right. Nobody else.
Yeah. And why is that?
Because.
Where are they coming from?
Well, blaming, mainly. But I mean, if I'm unhappy, it's usually because somebody else made me unhappy, rather than me admitting that I don't have to be unhappy because of what someone else says to me. I mean, but I've been with groups of people in divorce situations who simply will not take ownership that when they're angry, when they have been angry with their spouse, that was not their spouse's fault.
Yes.
But they could not own that when I'm angry because I make a decision to be angry about what's happening to them. And I think that that's a fairly common, maybe cultural, I don't know exactly where it comes from, but I think if you ask most people, if their anger came from a decision that they made to be angry, my bet would tell you, 9 out of 10 would tell you no.
That's such a beautiful point, and it's so powerful. And where that comes, how that fits into what we've been talking about,
yeah,
is that when we slip into a low state of mind, we get angry, and the quality of our thinking is in the tank, and you ask us what we're mad about, and I know it's Lori's fault. I know, it's obvious to me that it's her fault, right? When we're angry, that's what it looks like to us. Now, if I sleep on it and I get my healthy state of mind back and you ask me the next day what it was about, now I have a sense of perspective. Now I realize, well, yeah, there were some things she did that kind of aggravated me, but the truth is I was as guilty as she was, and I kind of started it by blah, blah, blah. And you get your balance back. You get your perspective. Now, what you're describing is some people who have gotten into that unhealthy state of mind in a certain relationship, and they're locked in. They have decided that that other person is guilty. That person is responsible for how I feel. And that's why it's so helpful in those situations to teach them. First of all, we get them on a retreat and we help them quiet down and help them back to a nicer feeling. We haven't solved the marriage problem yet, but they have to get to a nicer feeling first. And then when you start, you teach them where how thought and experience work, they start to see, oh, the only way for me to have a feeling is for me to have a thought. If Lori does something that aggravates me, sorry for using you as an example, honey.
That's okay.
But let's say she does something and I don't know she did it. Is it going to make me angry? If I don't find out about it, it's never going to make me angry, is it? The only way it can make me angry is if I think about it. If I find out about it, I think, boy, that was inconsiderate, or boy, that was not right. Now I'm angry. That's what you're saying, is that I've decided to get angry. I've had that thought. I'm creating the feeling.
Aren't there some things we should be angry about?
Yeah, that came up the other day. You know, situations of justice, injustice. But there's anger that's coming out of insecurity and reaction to things and low quality state of mind. And then there's anger that comes from a fully engaged, healthy state of mind that's coming from wisdom. Now, I think the Dietrich Bonhoeffer film was, you know, an amazing example of some people who decided to stand up to the Nazi regime. And there certainly was anger in that, I think, and it was justifiable anger. So I think that makes sense. But it's anger coming from wisdom rather than insecurity and pettiness. Does that make sense to you? I mean, that's just how it looks to me.
Is betrayal? Christ was betrayed, but one feels angry at betrayal of trust.
Yeah.
Is that justifiable anger? Yeah, or?
Well, that gets in that's an interesting situation. Let's say we've all had situations where we've felt betrayed in some way. Is that fair? I mean, we've all experienced betrayal at some level. And it absolutely hurts. It's offensive. And I would say it's certainly natural to feel hurt and angry about that. But then the question comes, let's say we have this event, and we justifiably feel angry, which means we had thoughts of anger. They're legitimate thoughts of anger. They led to anger. And then we have this whole thing going out there. But now the experience is over. Now, for different people, the length of time that this takes is different. But at what point do you decide, let's say it's 6 months later. 6 months later,
Can you relive that anger?
If you choose to.
Some people.
Easy. All we have to do is bring it to mind. And when we bring it to mind, because the principles of thought, mind, and consciousness work so beautifully, we get to live that anger all over again. And it changes our biochemistry. We literally, physically, and emotionally, and spiritually relive that anger. And some people do that. I guess I can't do that. Some people do that for a lifetime. Right? Yeah. See how that works? So at some point, if someone who's caught up in that, feeling a grudge, for example, if they can see, okay, it happened, it was bad, but now it's over. I have the choice. I have this creative, God-given ability to choose. I can keep bringing that to mind and blowing on the flame and re-experiencing that experience or not. It's up to me. It's just literally up to me. Since I create my experience with my thinking, I can create hell on earth for myself and live there, or I can create a nicer experience. Now, we're not talking about the power of positive thinking. We're talking about finding our way to a healthier state of mind, that feeling that we all recognize, that Holden state of mind, if you will. And in that state of mind, we look for an insight that helps us see what we've been doing to ourselves with different eyes. And when we see from with different eyes, we see that we don't have to stay caught up in it for the rest of our lives if we don't want to. We don't have to stay caught up with it for 5 more minutes. Now, sometimes it takes months and years for people to change, but I'm telling you, people can change on a dime if they have a flash of insight that's powerful enough.
Where does this insight come from? Being with others, how do they tap into this insight?
You know, I was thinking about that this morning as I was sitting up by the waterfall. You asked really good questions. And I was thinking about how in our culture, we are really taught to trust our 5 senses, whatever they are, smell, touch, mm-hmm. taste, the rest. And we're also taught to touch, to respect and appreciate and value our intellect. That's why IQ is such a big thing in our educational system, at least it used to be. But what we miss is that sixth sense that we all have, that intuition, that wisdom, that common sense, that Christ consciousness, that inkling, those inklings, that quiet voice within that we all have access to. That's one of the reasons why spending more time in a Holden state of mind, regardless of what our circumstances are, regardless of where we are, makes sense, because in that state of mind, we have access to our wisdom.
I think your word quiet is very important. And I'm not sure that all, that some people have quite a bit of difficulty in finding quiet. And maybe that could be taught, you know, but that's a, you know, just like we teach people to take care of themselves by taking a long warm bath or going for a walk, or, you know, maybe they need to be taught that insight is hard to come by if they don't have some downtime.
Wouldn't it be nice if that were taught in our culture? Wouldn't it be nice if we had classes in elementary schools and middle schools and high schools on finding quiet, quiet mind class? quiet mind class. We're down to the last 15 minutes, so here's what I'd like to end with. What happens is we go home and we get caught up in it. We just get caught up in it, don't we? We get caught up in the responsibilities and the busyness and the hustle and bustle. We lose our bearings. We talked the other day about the importance of having a still point that we can work from. And we talked about how before the principle of gravity was discovered, people looked at the movement of the planets, the rising and setting of the sun, and the ebb and flow of the tides, and they were mystified, and they were stupefied, and they had no idea how to explain all of this. And when we're in that situation, we've got the tides, and we've got the movement of the planets, and we've got the setting sun. If we don't understand the principle behind it, and we're confused and disturbed by what we see, what we experience with our five senses, what we tend to do is keep focusing on these, call them form. This is the world of form. So people came up with all kinds of scientific and astrological and theological theories to try to explain the mystery of what they saw and experienced with their senses. And then Isaac Newton discovered the principle of gravity. And suddenly, all of this world of forms made sense. Now, the principle of gravity is in the world of the formless. You can't box gravity and sell it. But you can feel the tides coming in and out. So this principle of gravity has an infinite number of manifestations in the world of form. And if you try to understand that infinite world of form, it just gets very complicated and very confusing and just too much for us to get our minds around. But if we understand the one simple principle of gravity, this all starts to make sense. And I'd like to suggest that this principle of gravity is a manifestation of the universal creative intelligence. that lies behind the world of form. Now we call the universal creative intelligence that flows through all the universe, we call this God. This universal creative intelligence manifests in the principle of gravity, which explains an infinite number of forms. Are you with me so far with this metaphor? Okay, now let's translate this to human experience. We were talking earlier about all the issues of human experience, pain, stress, hunger, painful relationships, war, plates too full, loved ones, and the rest. That's the stuff. That's the form of life. That's where we live. This is all the stuff that we experience with our five senses. Now the problem occurs when we try to answer our problems by looking here. And it just gets so complicated. And we end up just saying, I don't know what to do. I don't know why there's all this war, and I don't know why people are so horrible, and I don't know how to fix it, and I just feel overwhelmed. Looking at the world of form is exhausting. And because there's no end to it, if we try to fix it, there's just no end to it, is there? It's just endless. And what we've been talking about this week are the principles of thought, which is the capacity we have to create our experience, the principle of consciousness, which is the light that flows through the film of the camera. The film is our thinking. Consciousness is the light that brings it to light and makes it seem real. So we not only think our thoughts and create our experience, but we experience it as real. And it all flows from mind, which is nothing more than a psychological term for source or origin. These are the principles. And the principles are a manifestation of the universal creative intelligence of the universe, of God. And so when we get in trouble in our daily lives, it's always helpful not to look here, but to look to the principle behind. In simple practical terms, what that means is when we go home and we start losing our Holden state of mind, think of the principles of thought, mind, and consciousness, and ask yourself, what am I thinking? Notice your thinking, because that's where your new experience of stress is, or whatever it is coming from. It's not coming from the traffic, it's not coming from the circumstances. It's coming from your own thinking. Look within. And recognize that when we do that, we just naturally tend to quiet down. We naturally tend to get more philosophical about how we see things. And as we quiet down, we can access that sixth sense, that Christ consciousness, that insight, that wisdom, that will tell us sometimes utterly simple, practical things like you need a nap. You need a nap. Or, yes, people are asking you to do ten things, but realistically, I can only do two and maintain my own health. So I'm going to say no to these eight. When we understand the principle behind what's happening, we're less likely to get caught up in it. And that experience opens us up to Source, to God, speaking through us, through our wisdom and our common sense, through our Christ consciousness. So now we're not looking to the world of form to solve it. We're not getting overwhelmed by all the problems that we experience. But we're quieting down. We're moving into a healthy state of mind, which is the gift that God gave us. And He gave us all these resources available to us when we're in that state of mind. It's built in. It occurred to me as I was hiking back this morning that one way of looking at Christ's message is that what Christ, Christ's whole message was about was for us to drop all of our thought systems, whatever they are, whether they're political or theological or family or whatever. Just let go of all of them and live in the moment, in the presence of God, in the presence of Spirit. To be in the moment, quiet, and directly access Spirit, directly access common sense and wisdom. It's almost like living life as an improvisation. I play in a rock and roll band. Anybody else here in a rock and roll band? How many rock and roll band people do we have here? I guess I'm the only one. But one of the things I love about playing in a music with people is that you have five or six people that get in a feeling with one another, and you improvise, and you've got certain boundaries, but within those boundaries, you respond in a very creative and instinctive way. And I think it's possible to live life that way, to spend more time in this healthy state of mind, develop an ear for that sixth sense, and listen for wisdom. Any final comments or questions? I would like to thank every one of you for coming today, and some of you have been coming for days now, and I'm just really deeply touched that you've chosen to do that. I know that you have many options here, and thank you so much for coming and sharing. It's much more interesting to do this if I'm not the only one in the room. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.